I want you to take a second and like really visualize your
Oh,
workplace.
that's a dangerous game.
Right. Or, even your industry as a whole. When you really strip away all those polished mission statements and just think about the day-to-day reality of it, what does it actually feel like?
Yeah, the literal feeling.
Exactly. Like, are you constantly hacking your way through this chaotic jungle, just fighting to survive until Friday?
I think a lot of people feel that way, honestly.
Yeah, me too. Or, on the flip side, does it feel more like you're locked in this intense zero-sum game of chess, where you're constantly trying to outmaneuver the competition and, hoard resources and optimize your strategy?
Well, I mean, it's a really visceral question, right? Because depending on which of those environments you picture in your head, the way you behave, the way you make decisions changes completely.
Totally. And the way you view the people sitting at the desks around you, too.
Right. Are they threats in the jungle or are they pawns on the chessboard?
Exactly. And we usually assume the solution to, surviving that jungle or winning that chess match is just better strategy. We get so obsessed with strategic foresight.
Oh, absolutely. We think if we just scan the horizon a little bit better or gather more data, we can finally win the game.
Right. But today, we're exploring a completely different perspective. What if that very obsession with like winning the current game is actually the exact thing holding you back?
Which is, it's a deeply uncomfortable thought for anyone whose entire job description revolves around writing those big strategic plans.
It really is. So, what if instead of just strategizing to win, we need to completely transform the game itself? And I mean, more importantly, transform the self that is actually playing the game.
Yeah, that's the real challenge.
That is the core intellectual tension of this deep dive. Today, we are unpacking a 2021 conversation published in the World Futures Review. It's a dialogue between two really prominent future scholars, Soheil Inayatullah and John A. Sweeney.
And, this dialogue isn't just some abstract academic debate. This paper outlines a really profound conceptual shift in how organizations and individuals handle the future.
Right, they're advocating for a move away from traditional strategic foresight towards something much deeper.
Yeah, what they call transformative foresight.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really grasp this shift from strategizing to transforming, we first need to understand the map they use.
The spatial map, yeah.
Right, the sources provide this really cool spatial framework to help you visualize exactly where you and your organization are spending your time and energy. It builds on a concept originally developed by Hardin Tibbs.
Yeah, Tibbs' strategic landscape model. It's a brilliant way of using physical space to understand time and intention.
So how does Inayatullah change it?
Well, he takes Tibbs' original model and adapts it into four distinct spatial zones. So at the highest point, you have the star.
The star.
Right. This represents the ultimate vision, the core purpose. It's, the guiding light that gives an organization its true north, pulling it toward this desired future.
Okay, so then moving down from the sky to the earth, we have the mountaintops.
Exactly. This is the big picture view. It represents different scenarios and like different vantage points on the horizon.
And then below that, we find the chessboard.
Yes. The realm of strategy, power, optimization. It's highly rational and structural.
And very zero sum, right?
Right. Where one person's win is literally another's loss. And then finally, at the very bottom, we have the jungle,
The jungle.
which represents the really messy lived experience of institutions.
This framework reminds me so much of an open world video game map.
Oh, how so?
Well, in those games, you can pull up your menu and look at your player stats, right?
Yeah.
And it tells you exactly what percentage of your total playtime you've spent in different
Oh,
biomes.
yeah.
Like, it'll say, you spent 5% of your time in the Crystal Castle and 95% of your time trudging through the Poison Swamp.
That is exactly it. When Inayatullah consults with organizations, that's essentially the audit he asks them to perform.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He has teams map their operational hours across these four zones. They have to sit down and honestly answer, like, how much of our collective energy is spent looking at the star?
Versus how much is spent fighting in the jungle.
Exactly.
But I noticed in the text that the author specifically modified the original model. Like he added the jungle and he changed a single mountaintop into plural mountaintops. Why did he feel the need to invent the jungle and pluralize the mountains?
Right. What's fascinating here is that the inclusion of the jungle is vital because honestly, most of our lived experience in institutions is not a neat, rational chessboard.
Right. It's definitely not.
It's this uncomfortable reality of red tape, passive aggression, bullying, and just sheer survival.
Yeah, there's that line from the paper, Survival not of the fittest, but the most passive-aggressive.
I love that line.
It's so true. It highlights how much energy is just totally wasted navigating bureaucracy.
Exactly. And regarding the plural mountaintops, that indicates there is no single objective vantage point from which to view the future.
So it's about perspective.
Right. We operate from radically different cosmologies and epistemologies, which basically means we have different fundamental beliefs about the universe and how we validate what's true.
So, like, a tech startup in Silicon Valley and a rural public healthcare system, they look at the horizon from entirely different mountaintops.
Perfectly said. They don't just have different goals, they process reality differently.
Okay, so if that's the terrain, the visionary star, the plural mountaintops, the rational chessboard, and the chaotic jungle, it really raises the question of how individuals usually navigate it.
And where it all falls apart.
Right. Because the paper argues that much of the foresight field has basically become permanently trapped on the chessboard.
Yeah. The tragic flaw of traditional strategic foresight is that it assumes life is ultimately just about power. It's driven by what the paper calls the rational, anxious pusher self.
The pusher self? That sounds stressful.
It is. This version of the self views the future not as, you know, a realm of emergence or possibility, but merely as a space for risk mitigation.
Right, they're scanning the horizon purely defensively.
Yeah, just to make sure no one is going to sneak up and steal the games they've already made.
The future just becomes another game to win. And here's where it gets really interesting. The paper shares this anecdote about a tech executive taking a 5-day futures course that just illustrates this perfectly.
Oh, the prepackaged solution lady.
Yes. So she pulls the instructors aside and suggests that, you know, to be efficient and save everyone time, they should just skip the 5 days and immediately give her the answer to the future.
Right. She just wanted the deliverable. And one of the instructors smiles at her and says, "Yes, I know what the problem is. You."
Which is brutal. But, you know, he didn't mean she was personally malicious. He meant the particular self she brought to the room was the problem.
The anxious, optimizing self.
Yeah, the self that insisted on treating the future like a cheat code to be consumed. Once she realized her own mindset was the barrier, she actually stayed for the course and championed the work.
It's a great breakthrough.
It is. But I want to push back slightly here, or at least play devil's advocate for a second.
Sure.
I mean, if you are a busy executive and you've got shareholders breathing down your neck and a board demanding quarterly results, isn't it entirely rational to just want a concrete answer?
Of course it is.
You want to mitigate risk and get back to operations. So why does the paper go so far as to call this mindset a tragedy? I mean, that's a very heavy philosophical word.
It is a heavy word, and they use it intentionally.
Yeah.
They're drawing directly on Friedrich Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy.
Okay, bringing in Nietzsche.
Right. So Nietzsche argued that a healthy culture balances the Dionysian side, which is, you know, communal, emotive, chaotic, and emergent, with the Apollonian side.
Which is the structured, rational, individual side.
Exactly. So the tragedy, in Nietzsche's view, happened when the purely rational Socratic self completely took over and crushed the emotive and communal aspects of human nature.
Ah, I see. So the authors are arguing that the exact same tragedy has happened in strategic foresight.
Bingo. The strategic identity is essentially a Socratic self. It separates itself from nature, it separates itself from others, and it treats the future just as a product to analyze and control.
And it views the futurist as like this all-knowing oracle handing down prophecies from the mountaintop.
Right, which transformative foresight rejects entirely.
It argues the futurist shouldn't be an expert handing down answers at all.
No, they should be a guide, helping a group navigate a learning journey. It's about focusing on the space between the mountaintops and the star.
Navigating the fear and anxiety of creating something completely new.
Yeah, the author phrases it so beautifully. He says, it's not a hero's journey, it's a collective caravan.
A collective caravan. Wow. I mean, shifting from a solo hero's journey to a caravan that changes the entire physics of leadership.
It really does.
But okay, if transformative foresight requires rewriting the self rather than just drafting a new strategic plan, how does a rigid defensive bureaucracy actually do that?
Without falling apart, you mean?
Right. It sounds great in theory, but changing human nature within a strict institution is notoriously difficult.
Well, the paper argues that to change reality, you have to change your foundational metaphors.
Your internal mythology.
Exactly. You have to change the story you are telling yourselves about who you are and where you live, on that spatial map we talked about.
Okay, so the case study of the Norwegian Ministry of Education demonstrates this perfectly.
Oh, this is a great example.
Yeah, so when the futurists went in, the prevailing metaphor within the ministry was that they were a castle surrounded by hungry wolves.
Which is an incredibly defensive posture. I mean, think about it. If you believe you're in a castle and everyone outside is a wolf, you are firmly entrenched on the chessboard, playing defense.
Or you're just hiding in the jungle.
Right. You're operating entirely from a place of fear, convinced that external stakeholders are literally out to get you.
So the transformative work wasn't just handing them some new policy agenda. It was rewriting that myth. They moved the narrative from the castle and the wolves to a jazz orchestra.
And that changes everything. Think about how a jazz orchestra functions. The goal is still individual excellence, right? But it only works through deep listening and real-time adaptation to the people around you.
It's not a rigid top-down symphony where everyone is just reading sheet music.
No, it relies on emergence. The music reviews itself through the collective interaction.
So what does this all mean for daily operations? Well, if you're a jazz musician, your job isn't to defend a wall. Your job is to find the harmony.
Exactly. And this mirrors the NBA analogy the paper brings up.
Oh, right, regarding basketball coach Mike D'Antoni.
Yeah. So for a long time, traditional basketball strategy was built around what they call hero ball.
Find your absolute best player, give them the ball, clear out, and let them take the shot.
Right. Which is the ultimate expression of the anxious push yourself on the chessboard. It relies on one person executing a rigid plan.
But D'Antoni shifted the paradigm. He argued that the team needed to focus on energy. He allowed the flow of the ball and the movement of the players to actually dictate the play.
The energy creates the emergence.
Yeah.
You trust the system and the people to react to real-time information rather than trying to force a predetermined outcome.
Okay, but let's bring this back to the most resistant environments. The example of the National Law Enforcement Agency is so striking to me.
Yeah, that one is intense.
Right, because they were starting a new future center, and the agents were fully prepared to deliver these dry, chessboard-style environmental scans about an impending tsunami of crime.
Classic jungle survival mode. They were terrified.
Mm. But the futurist didn't force them out of the jungle immediately. He didn't just walk in and say, "Stop worrying about crime and look at the beautiful stars."
No, that would never work.
Instead, he asked them within their own framework to identify their narrative and their character in the story.
And their responses were incredibly revealing.
Totally. One agent identified as the machete bearer, clearing a path in the jungle to get the villagers to safety.
And another identified as the white witch, providing crucial intelligence on new crime types to figure out who needed to be convinced.
So they didn't deny the mud they were standing in. They used these rich mythological narratives to navigate to higher ground.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is a masterclass in what the author calls entering a client's epistemological commons.
Epistemological commons. Okay, so if epistemology is the study of how we know things and a commons is like a shared public space, we are basically talking about the shared mental sandbox a specific group plays in.
Yes. The shared cultural logic they use to make sense of the world. Look, if a group is in pain or feeling deeply disempowered in the jungle, you cannot empower them by handing them a spreadsheet of abstract trend analysis from the mountaintop.
It just won't compute.
Exactly. You have to meet them where their energy is. You must use tools to dig beneath the surface events and uncover those deep narratives.
Let's actually break down the tool the paper emphasizes for this. Causal layered analysis, or CLA. Because it's not just a buzzword here. It's the actual mechanism for how this transformation happens.
Right. CLA forces an organization to stop staring at the day-to-day headlines, which it calls the litany, and dig downward.
It's a four-layered descent.
Yep. So you start at the litany, the observable problems. For the law enforcement agency, the litany is just crime is going up.
Right, the obvious stuff.
Then the second layer down is systemic causes, like perhaps budget cuts to social programs.
Okay, and the third layer?
The third layer is the worldview or discourse driving the system.
Hmm.
Something like, we are the thin blue line protecting society from evil.
And then you reach the bottom layer, the myth or metaphor. We are the castle surrounded by wolves.
Exactly. CLA shows that if you only try to solve the litany on the surface using some new strategy, but your underlying myth remains a defensive castle, your strategy will fail.
As the old saying goes, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yeah, and the author reiterates that point with a great sense of humor. He says, strategic foresight merely means ensuring you have a better breakfast than others.
That's hilarious. But it's true. If the deep culture hasn't transformed, your shiny new strategy is just going to be devoured by old habits.
Right. You might have a great vision, but if the self executing it is still the anxious survivor, you'll slide right back into the jungle.
There's a concept mentioned from the Indian philosopher and spiritual leader P.R. Sarkar that really captures this tension perfectly.
The lotus flower.
Yes, the lotus flower. Sarkar's work often focused on bridging the spiritual and the material. And the lotus lives in the mud, right? Its roots are deep in the muck of the jungle, but it keeps its gaze fixed entirely on the moon or the star.
It's the idea that you can exist in the messy bureaucratic reality without losing your connection to your ultimate purpose.
It completely bridges the gap between the lowest point on the map and the highest.
Which brings us to the ultimate friction point. We can talk about lotuses and jazz orchestras all day long, but
Monday morning still happens.
Monday morning still
You
happens.
spend the weekend at an offsite retreat, you gaze at the star, you find your inner lotus flower, and then Monday hits. The bills are due, the emails are piling up, and the jungle comes roaring back.
Oh, yeah, it always does.
How do you keep the star alive when the chessboard demands your immediate attention?
Ah, the Monday morning problem. It's the ultimate test of any vision. But interestingly, the author notes that transformative foresight is actually easier to implement today than it was decades ago.
Wait, really? That seems completely counterintuitive given how chaotic the global landscape is right now.
Well, paradoxically, the chaos is exactly why it's easier. Systemic disruptions, and the paper specifically points to the COVID-19 pandemic, have already proved to everyone that the chessboard is fragile.
Oh, I see.
You no longer have to convince leaders that unpredictable disruption is possible. The illusion of total control has been shattered. We are all actively living in the future.
The old rigid strategies failed so spectacularly that people are finally open to trying something based on emergence rather than control.
Exactly. But, you know, that tension of bridging the long-term vision with daily operations still remains.
Yeah. And the paper provides a fantastic example of a healthcare CEO who managed this tension with just incredible discipline.
Right. So they had gathered 50 CEOs from rural healthcare systems, and they developed this beautiful transformative vision for healthcare in the year 2030. They wanted a system that was personalized, preventative, and participatory.
But the overseeing director pointed out the exact Monday morning problem. He basically said, "I can't see the link between this beautiful 2030 star and what my staff are actually supposed to do tomorrow."
So they broke into action learning groups and designed seven immediate short-term projects that could be executed on the chessboard right now. And the director funded all seven of them right there.
But that creates a danger, doesn't it? If you only fund the short-term projects, all the energy just gets pulled right back down into the daily grind.
And the 2030 vision gets totally forgotten.
Yeah. So to counter this, the director took 25% of the total budget and dedicated it exclusively to the 2030 preventive vision, the STAR.
It's brilliant. He funded the Monday morning projects to handle the present, but he literally walled off a quarter of the organization's resources to ensure the long-term emergent future was protected.
You handle the jungle, you play the necessary moves on the chessboard, but you financially guarantee that a significant portion of your organization is living on the mountaintops, looking up.
It ensures that your daily strategy actually emerges from your ultimate purpose, rather than just being a series of, knee-jerk reactions to whatever predator is currently roaming the jungle.
This raises a vital question for you listening to this right now. We've talked a lot about institutional frameworks and executive budgets today, but this all trickles down to the individual level.
It has to.
The core argument of this paper is that you are an active part of the future you are trying to create. The future isn't just some weather event that happens to you. The future is using you to come into being.
Which requires a really profound level of self-awareness. It's not about judging the different selves you bring to work. It's about recognizing them. Because once you are aware of the self you are embodying, you actually have the freedom to change it.
Think about that spatial map. Think about the star, the mountaintops, the chessboard, and the jungle. Which self did you bring to work today?
Are you the anxious survivor, just gripping the steering wheel and hoping to make it through the jungle without drawing attention?
Are you the aggressive pusher, treating every single meeting like a zero-sum move on a chessboard you just have to win?
Or are you looking for the energy, trying to connect the daily mud to the light of the star?
But if transformative foresight truly means we are abandoning the solo hero's journey, if we are all co-creating the future together on a shared caravan, relying on emergence rather than control, it leaves us with a lingering, difficult question.
What's that?
When we look up from the jungle and we inevitably disagree on the destination, whose star are we actually following?